When you need to refuel between meetings or running errands, or you just want a healthy snack that squashes your hunger, Wonderful Pistachios, which come in a variety of flavors and sizes, by the way, are the perfect choice to fill you up and keep you going throughout the day. Wonderful Pistachios is also a good source of protein and a zero-guilt snack. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, guys, which gives you over 10% of your daily value. And with flavors like salt and pepper, sweet chili, and seasoned salt in the shelled variety, options like chili roasted, sea salt, and vinegar or jalapeno lime in the no-shell variety, you're sure to please your taste buds while snacking healthy. So check out wonderfulpistachios.com to learn more about how these little green wonders can power up your day.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey guys, I know we're all working so hard to stay fit and healthy at home, so check out my app. I have free daily 7-minute workouts. Download the app. It's Jillian Michaels Fitness app. Download it. Do the 7-minute workouts. You don't need any equipment. There's total body workouts, ab workouts, leg workouts. You get a new one every single day. And if you want more, obviously, there's a heck of a lot more in the app. There's over 1,000 different exercises. All of my DVD workouts are in the app. I can customize a workout for you in the app. There's freaking yoga, kickboxing, HIIT training, outdoor runs, bodyweight training, free weights. There are thousands of recipes, no matter what your diet preferences are. But at the very least, please do the 7-minute workouts for free.
I'm still going to say Happy New Year. Happy New Year, everybody.
Let's hope so.
Yeah, it's only the second week of January. And we are on the up and up. We are coming out of an incredible New Year's show with Kelly McGonigal. We're energizingly hopeful. We're energized and hopeful. We have energized hope, Cindy.
Yeah.
Right?
I do.
And following Kelly, which is not an easy thing to do, I think we have a pretty amazing guest today. We have a gentleman by the name of Stephen Kotler. Now, he's coming on to talk to us about his new book, The Art of Impossible, a peak performance primer. And, you know, there have been a lot of books, got to be honest, that talk about, oh, you know, and I myself have been guilty of it, right? It's like Unlimited, How to Lead Your Best Life. This book is a little bit different, maybe a lot different, in that this gentleman, his work has been nominated for 2 Pulitzer Prizes. 2, right? He has had literally 12 books, all of which are New York Times bestsellers. He is one of the most accomplished neuroscience researchers, award-winning journalists. I mean, he's quite honestly a genius, literally. And I had the pleasure of reading his book in preparing for this interview, and I thought, my God, like, he actually gives you a formula to achieve, quote, the impossible. And don't be intimidated, because according to Stephen, there are 2 different kinds of impossible, right? Because you're thinking, well, like, look, only so many of us can be Einstein, which, by the way, he addresses in the book, and I'll have him speak to. But there's a different kind of impossible, and it's what we think is impossible for us, but what we actually really, really want and what we really, really should be doing. And I've spoken about this personally, right? Like, oh, you know, you're not doing the world any favors by living small, and oh, your dreams are your destiny, pursue them. But this guy specializes in neuroscience, and he has broken down the mechanisms, quite literally, of greatness in a way that are accessible and attainable. You know, and when we did a little pre-interview, and, you know, because he's an award-winning journalist, we kind of got off topic, and He was telling me about different interviews he'd done and how one individual had put him through the paces for like an hour and a half before they realized he was the real deal. And I was like, you know, dude, and I told him about years ago how there was like a New York Times piece on me and how I can never, ever do an interview without having to be a piece of shit in one way or another, right? It's like, but she's kind of a piece of shit this way, or she's kind of a piece of shit that way. My dog is very passionate about that as well. And you know what he said? He goes, that's actually something in journalism called the ugly nose. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he goes, if I tell you that the person is just great, you know, you're not going to believe me unless somewhere I tell you that they're flawed, right? And I thought to myself, that's such bullshit. I'm never going to have a guest on and go, hey, look at their ugly nose, or point out a flaw, because that's not why they are guests on this show. So I want everybody listening to understand that the individuals that are chosen to be guests on this show are the opposite of the ugly nose. They are all human, hence the reason I asked them to tell us their origin story, right? But they are, in my opinion, outliers. They are geniuses, whether it's Dr. William Lee, you know, curing the world of cancer, every blueberry at a time, or Kelly McGonigal, who is reshaping our happiness and our daily mood with movement, or now Stephen Kotler, who is showing us that our greatest wishes for ourselves are not only within our reach, that the alternative is a non-starter. So there is no ugly nose guest on this show. Every person that is selected for a very special and specific reason, special to me, and in hopes that what gifts they have given me with their work and their knowledge, I can then turn around and share with everybody listening in a way that will allow us to lead a better, more meaningful, happier, more purpose-filled life, period. End of story. So on that note, we'll take a quick break, and we will be right back with Stephen Kotler talking about his newest book, The Art of Impossible.
So my mom has this cat, Musette, and she's a great cat. We all love her, but we can't stand the smell of her litter box. And you know, a cat lives there as soon as you walk in the door because of that smell. So my mom decided to try Pretty Litter, and the problem has been solved, team. It's got these super light crystals that literally trap the smell and leave you with dry, low-maintenance, dust-free litter. And Pretty Litter also has this amazing extra innovation. It monitors your cat's health by changing colors when it detects potential underlying issues. Plus, Pretty Litter is delivered in a small, lightweight bag that lasts up to a month, so my mom doesn't have to run out to a store and lug it back home. And shipping is free. Get the world's smartest litter without leaving home by visiting prettylitter.com and use the promo code Jillian for 20% off your first order. That's prettylitter.com, promo code Jillian for 20% off. prettylitter.com, promo code Jillian. We're all hanging around the house a lot more these days, so I decided to check out some sweats from Vuori. And oh my God, I'm living in them. The Laguna lounge pants, heaven. And I also hear the performance joggers are amazing, so I'm going to be checking those out next. But Vuori has all kinds of workout gear too, like leggings and sports bras that are just as comfortable and look incredible on. And they have all kinds of stuff for men and women. Vuori is an investment in your happiness. And for our listeners, they're offering 20% off your first purchase. So get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet at VuoriClothing.com/Jillian. That's V-U-O-R-I clothing.com/Jillian. And not only will you get 20% off your first purchase, but you'll enjoy free shipping on any U.S. orders over $75 with free returns. Go to VuoriClothing.com/Jillian and discover the versatility of Vuori clothing.
All right, team, we are back with Stephen Kotler, New York Times bestselling author, award-winning journalist, executive director of the Flow Research Collective, nominated for 2 Pulitzer Prizes, and you run a dog sanctuary called Rancho de Chihuahua. So for our listeners who are just becoming familiar with you, what the hell do you do in idiot terms? And How did you get into this?
I started out my career very early on as a journalist. I've always been a writer. I was trained as a poet, and then I became a novelist, and I was writing fiction. And so it was like, how the hell do I get paid while I'm writing novels? Because novels don't make any money. And I fell into journalism. And journalism is literally about exploiting your curiosity, right? Anything you're really, really interested in, you want to write about. And I was really interested in sort of neuroscience and psychology, mostly neuroscience, and really interested in action sports. Don't ask, but those were my passions. And I fell into working in action sports. And in the 1990s, when I started, they talk about action sports, surfing, skiing, rock climbing, all that stuff. It's the great era of impossible. More never before feats were done in a short period of time than ever before in history. And I was kind of hanging out with the people who were actually doing this. And it's sort of, it's one thing when you see it on a screen, you're like, oh my God, that man or woman just accomplished the impossible. It's another thing when it's your friend and you've gone drinking with them on Friday night, and Saturday morning you get up and you go skiing, and that person does something that for all of recorded history has never been done and is not supposed to ever be possible. It's a totally different kind of what the hell is going on here. And I started saying, well, what the hell is going on here? Also, if action sports in the 1990s was sort of like a home for wayward youth. Everybody I knew had a terrible childhood. They had very little money. They had very little education. And there were a lot of drugs and alcohol. So if you
Gen
put
X
those things together,
in
right?
Yep,
Gen X
I'm
in
with
that show, yes.
Yes, 100%.
What do you normally get? What do you get? You get like people in jail or die young and whatever. You don't get people who reinvent what's possible for the human species. And so I was like, well, what the hell is going on? Why is this, what is going on? And because I was into neuroscience, I was using neuroscience to try to understand it. What's the neurobiology? What's going on in the brain underneath that? I took that question of what does it take to accomplish the impossible out of action sports by kind of my mid-20s and into every domain you can imagine. I asked the question, what does it take to do the impossible in science, in technology, in culture, in art, in business? And what I do today, and by the way, whenever you see the impossible become possible, you see two things. You see people learning to harness disruptive accelerating technology and people finding ways to extend human capability. Those
hold
two
on,
things.
Hold on, wait. Disruptive accelerated technology.
Just what using.
What does that mean? Before we go further.
Yeah. All right, so I'm like, where I was going to go, we're on the human
what
side of it.
What did you just say?
So a disruptive technology is a technical term, and it means any technology that replaces an existing technology. So when silicon chips replaced vacuum tubes in computers, right?
Okay.
Or when, you know, CDs replaced albums, or when
it's a revolution, Apple, so to speak.
Yeah. And so people harnessing that kind of technology and people finding ways to extend human capability. And when you put them together, you actually tend to get impossible. That tends to be the formula. And so I wrote 6 or 7 books on technology, and I wrote 6 or 7 books on human performance. And today I run the Flow Research Collective, which we study the neurobiology of peak human performance. So what's going on in the brain and the body when people are performing at their best. And we're a research and training organization. You ask what I do on a daily basis and what I do. We're a research and training organization. On the research side, we're partnered with Stanford and USC and Imperial College London and a bunch of other institutions. And we study neuroscience, what goes on in the brain when people are performing at their best. And then we use what we learn to train everybody. And we train about 1,000 people a month, everybody from kind of U.S. Special Forces and Olympic athletes to, you know, soccer moms from Ohio to, you know, insurance brokers from New York to take your pick. So general public all the way up to the kind of peak performers. And that's what we do. And so I haven't been a journalist too much in the past 10 years because I've been focused predominantly on writing books and studying the neurobiology of peak human performance, but that's what I do. And yes, my wife and I run a dog sanctuary, so I also do that.
So I really wanted to dive in on the definition of impossible because so the new book, everyone, the new book that we're here to talk about today is called The Art of the Impossible, a Peak Performance Primer. And when you say impossible, what does that actually mean? Like, what if I'm thinking there's no shot I'm, you know, because you even say in the book, like, okay, you know, what if you're not Einstein? What if you're not DiMaggio? Not everybody can be. So then what is the definition of impossible with regard to this book?
So there's two levels. In my opinion, there's two levels of impossible, and they're very related. And we'll get to how they're related at the very end of this. But there's this stuff I was seeing. Capital I impossible. This has never been done, and we don't think it's ever going to be done. And this could be intellectual impossibles, Einstein's theory of relativity. It could be cultural impossibles, Rosa Parks sitting at the front of the bus and saying no more. It could be athletic impossibles, 4-minute miles, right? This is capital I impossible. The book is based on 30 years of studying people who have accomplished capital I impossible. But what there really is small I impossible, and that which we believe is impossible for us. So I'll give you a simple example of my own life. When I was growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, I wanted to be a writer. From the time I was 5, I wanted to be a writer. We didn't have a lot of money. It was Cleveland, Ohio in the 70s when I was growing up, was like a blue-collar steel mill town. You know what I mean? I knew steel workers. I didn't know anybody was a writer. Like, me wanting to be a writer was like waking up one morning and be like, Mom, Dad, today I want to be an elf when I grow up. No. I want to be a hobbit. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't know any writers. I didn't know how the hell you became a writer. And so what I mean by impossible is there's no clear path between point A and point B, and they're statistically lousy odds of success. So what are small I impossible? Small I impossible, rising out of poverty, small I impossible. Overcoming any kind of deep trauma, small I impossible. Getting paid doing what you love in the world, big small I impossible for all of us. Becoming world class at anything you do. It could be stamp collecting, could be podcasting, it could be running track and field. All small I impossible. In fact, I think for most of us, when we're kids, I think getting a boyfriend or a girlfriend or a first kiss or a first date, like that's a small I impossible, right? And the thing I want everybody to understand here is that in 30 years of studying the impossible, one, I have never seen anybody who set out to accomplish capital I impossible. What happens is there's a formula, we can talk all about that, but you accomplish small I impossible after small I impossible after small I impossible. And usually if you talk to the people who actually accomplish capital I impossible, their experience isn't, oh my God, I did this thing that was impossible. It was, I did what was next. Laird Hamilton, big wave surfer.
Yes.
I met Laird for the first time. He was 33, I was 27. And he was widely acknowledged as like the baddest man on the planet at that point. He was surfing 50-foot waves. Nobody had ever seen anything like it. And I remember he said to me, we were talking, he's like, look, man, people see me, I'm 33 years old, they see me on a 50-foot wave, and they think, no way, man, that's freaking impossible, I could never do that. He's like, okay, fair enough, but what you don't see is me at 3 years old on a 3-foot wave, and 4 years old on a 4-foot wave, and 5 years old on a 5-foot wave, and you didn't see me last week on a 49.5-foot wave. That's what I mean by it's next. That's progression. What athletes talk about is progression. It's always invisible.
So, Stephen, what do you tell the people that do make excuses based on the shit that is legit out of your control?
There is always going to be stuff outside your control, right? There are always going to be radically extenuating circumstances. And I think there's, by the way, always going to be horrible crap that happens to us, right?
Yeah. Yes.
I don't know. You know, it's funny because I always say this about most of the successful people I know, and I think you'll agree with this. Every super successful person I know is running from something just as fast as they're running towards something. I've never met anybody super successful who isn't running from something, and myself included. And one of the reasons is it's too goddamn hard to get where you want to go. If you don't have that double motivation, if something isn't chasing you and you're running towards it, you have a much harder time getting there. You know who I worry about? I worry about the people who had a really easy time in high school. That's who I worry about. Honestly, it's people who had really easy childhoods where they were very beautiful, they were very smart, a lot was given to them early on. They have the much harder time in adulthood. The people who got their ass kicked usually have most of the skills you need. They just need to be pointed in the right direction.
Okay, well, you talk about, right, the quartet of skills. Mm-hmm. So we have motivation, learning, creativity, and flow. Now, of course, I'm going to want you to elaborate on all of those, but can these things stand alone? Must they work in unison? Like, do I need to have them all firing at the same time?
So
are they, is this the crawl, stand, walk, jog, run thing where I pick up one and then progress to the other?
Those are great questions. And motivation is a catch-all for a bunch of sub-skills, learning. These are catch-all terms, right? But whatever. First of all, let me give you a high-level framework so people can think about it. Motivation is what gets you in the game. Learning allows you to continue to play. Creativity allows you to steer. And remember, if you're going for impossible high, hard goals, the kind where you don't know from A to B, you need creativity. You need creative problem solving because you don't know how to get where you're going. And flow, which is the state of optimal performance, is how you turbo boost everything. Now, when I say that it doesn't matter where you look, impossible always has the same formula, flow is at the heart of that formula. When you look at what flow maximizes, it maximizes learning, creativity, and motivation, among other things. And one of the easy ways to think about this is you can have all these sub skills, of course. But if you want the maximum, right? The whole point here is if you do things in order in the right sequence, the way our biology has been designed to work, you get farther, faster, with a lot less work, less energy, it's less hard. That's the point. Here's the quick idea. So flow is a massive turbo boost. We can talk about why, and we can talk about the biology and the science, but just to give you an idea, motivation, productivity will jump 400-500%. Learning will increase 250%. This isn't so. The motivation study was done by McKinsey. Learning was the U.S. Department of Defense. They did that study. Creativity will soar 400-700%. That's work that we did, the Flow Research Collective, that's been done at Harvard, a bunch of other places, and so forth and so forth. But one of the things that happens is flow is this really big turbo boost. You go really fast in flow, but if you don't have the motivation skills locked in, or the learning skills and the creativity skills that are supercharged in flow, you can't handle the speed, right? It's like trying to drive a race car on like really crappy tires. It'll work for a little while, but sooner or later you're going to blow up. One example, easy way to explain it is, so flow states, which are these big performance states, they got triggers, preconditions that lead to more flow. We could talk about why and where they come from. One of the big ones, it's what's known as the challenge skills balance. This says we find the most flow when the challenge of the task at hand slightly exceeds our skill set. So you want to stretch your skills, but not snap, right?
When the learning zone, so to speak.
Exactly. So if you don't know how to learn, you can't use your skills to the utmost,
God,
right?
Of course. Think of it like that. Right.
So like what happens is if you don't have good learning skills, you may be able to get into flow, but you can't sustain the state over time because you can't keep up with it. So, and here's the bad news. Flow is one of the most pleasurable and addictive states on earth. So I can train you up, and flow is actually remarkably easy to train. You get the biology right, you get everything right, you'll get a 70-80% boost in flow. But if you don't have learning skills, you can't sustain it. And flow is optimal performance, and meaning it's when we perform our best, but it's also when we feel our best. So flow is a great, pleasurable, joyous, ecstatic cocktail. And if I give you a whole bunch of flow and then I cut it off, it's awful. You know, we started to realize that it's not the flow stuff. It's all the stuff you need to support the flow.
That's the framework. I understand. There was something that really triggered me. And it was when you wrote about the habit of inferiority. And I thought, holy shit, it is a habit. People, can you speak on that? Because so many I see suffer with it, and it's hard as hell to break them of that, by the way. Hard as hell. What is it, and why is it so hard to get rid of?
So the habit of inferiority, so this is an idea that comes from founder of psychology, William James, the guy who wrote the very first textbook in psychology. And he was talking about the phenomenon of a second wind. He said, you know, most of us are familiar with a second wind. You get to a certain level of fatigue, maybe it's cognitive fatigue, maybe it's physical fatigue, whatever, and you keep pushing it, and sooner or later you burst through. What most people don't know is you have a third wind, you have a fourth wind, you have a fifth wind, you have a sixth wind, And most people never find out how gritty they are because we get in the habit of inferiority. We get used to performing at suboptimal levels. And the reason it happens is this. Your body, I'm going to use a fancy word here, your body is a homeostatic creature, meaning the body has a fixed energy budget and it likes to perform at the same energy level. It doesn't like, so if you're performing at level X, you're working out hard, it does not want to kick into another gear, right? It just doesn't.
Yes.
I do a lot of skiing, and I was thinking about this very thing yesterday. I was tired, I was beat up, I was skiing. So the first five or six runs were, my body just wanted to cruise. It just would not warm up, right? Because I was just tired. I had to actually like dive into a mogul field and really force myself to turn fast and move to just get out of the habit of inferiority, which is literally a homeostatic mechanism. The body is here. And so if we don't train, the army has a maxim, which is train how you fight, fight how you train. And what they mean is literally like whatever level you're training at, whether it's physically or cognitive or whatever, your body is going to get accustomed to that and it won't want to move faster and it'll feel impossible. Or let me give you a different example that is very familiar to everybody from our professional lives. Most of us in your 20s, you had that experience where like there was a month or a point where you're like, oh my God, I'm working as fast as I can. I can't work any harder. I can't work any faster. And then like a year later, you're like, oh wow, I'm working twice as fast as I was last year. And I don't even know how this is possible. And it's because we acquired new skills, new learning, and it got easier as we got better. We've all had that experience along the way. We just don't often recognize it. Those are versions of the habit of inferiority. But I think people get really locked in along the way. And they stop expecting, you know, kind of miraculous performance out of themselves. But we're all, I mean, the point of Art of Impossible is after 30 years of looking at the science of this, it's very, very clear we are all hardwired for extraordinary. We're all hardwired for peak performance. It's a built-in part of being human. And not only are we hardwired to go big, we can come back to this later, but the research is pretty clear. Not going big, not trying to realize our full potential, sort of existing with the habit of inferiority is really bad for us.
Recipe for misery, I imagine.
There are eight major causes of depression. Two are the ones that get the most wrong. You've heard about them. Trauma, yes. Something really bad happened to me. I can't get over it. And genetics. I can't
those
make
are the
enough
two
serotonin
that I know
or
of.
Whatever.
That's it.
Right. Those are the two. It turns out those are actually red herrings. One, genetics alone will never produce depression or anxiety. Won't do it. Doesn't do it. It always has to be a compounded by an outside factor, another additional factor. And 90% of the time with trauma, maybe even more than 90, trauma leads to post-traumatic growth, not post-traumatic stress. We get our ass kicked and then we get better and stronger,
yes.
Right? And it's like Hemingway said, the world breaks everyone and many are stronger in the broken places, right? That's most of our experiences. There are six other major causes of depression. Let's pick one. Lack of meaningful work. What does that actually mean? This is one of the main, so let's talk about anxiety and depression for half a second. 1 out of 10 adults is going to come down with anxiety or depression this year, so it's an epidemic, and somebody kills themselves in America once every 12 seconds. So it's an epidemic with incredibly high consequences for all of us, right? Six major causes of depression outside of the two we addressed. Lack of meaningful work is one of them. What does that really mean? Work that is not, we're not curious about, we're not passionate about, it's not aligned with our purpose. We can't pursue with autonomy and freedom. We can't pursue with mastery, and it doesn't generate flow. That's what it technically means to have a lack of meaningful work, or lack of meaningful values is another one. Same kind of combination. The point is we are designed to optimize to our full potential. We are designed to go for it. Abraham Maslow, the famous psychologist, said it really briefly, and I think he was totally right. Whatever one can be, one must be.
Okay. But you're on something so significant, and I find that even in my own life, and I've been very lucky to love what I do, but I've had to fight for that, right? And I think there's, for so many, and I've noticed in particular in women, there is a guilt of like, well, that's not responsible. That's not what I should do. That's not the responsible thing to do. And people get so caught up in the shoulds. I got to pay bills. I got to get a real job. And I fell for that shit and never made less money in my life when I was in my 20s. But how do you break people of that? Because in saying like, no, you should do what you love. Really? Like, that's where the money is. That's the flow state. They're like, yeah, right. Okay. I'm going to make money, you know, being a dog trainer. And then of course I reference Caesar Millan, but they just don't see how they get from where they are to Caesar Millan, which of course is what your whole book is about. but, you know, I'm looking at this going, I can't make money doing what I love, or, you know, I have bills to pay. I don't have that luxury. How do you know what I mean? How
it's so one, the book opens with what I call the passion recipe. It's how do you turn curiosity into passion and passion into purpose? And that's like, start there, because that's specifically a formula for it. But the most important thing, so at the Flow Research Collective, I said we train about 1,000 people a month. Jesus. We train, there are two huge categories of who we work with. We work with usually C-suite executives, right? And we work with women in their 40s and 50s who are usually very kind of powerhouse ass kickers. And they paused to have a family. And now they're coming back and they want to go after that dream, right? That's the vast majority of who we work with all the time. This is, you're speaking directly to a lot of our clients and the people I get to work with. And I actually love working with women who are trying to reinvent themselves. I tend to like powerhouse women a lot in general. They're some of my favorite people. So I love the fact that we get to work with so many of these people. And the only thing I will tell you is, and you know this, Jillian, if you don't go after that thing that's inside you, your Caesar Millan fantasy, it is going to continue to bite you in the ass for the rest of your life. You're never going to run away from this thing. You're always going to what if yourself every kind of moment of your life. And trust me, because I train the people who they're 40 and they're 50 and they didn't do that. And they're coming to me because now is the time and they want to get back to it. And sooner, I mean, it's fine. Like, you can go after, we're going to, with the way longevity is progressing, we're going to get way more years of our life to go after our dreams. So maybe that's going to be a fine thing to do also. But I, you know, it's sooner or later, it's going to bite you in the ass. It just is. And is the first answer. The second thing is, nobody starts out, you know this, you find, this is the thing I'm curious about, this is the thing that makes money, how do they connect, right? You start there. You just don't want to start with this job that you can just get. Start with a couple of things you're curious about and then connect them with a way to make money. At least start there so you're actually feeding the thing, right? You don't have to do all of this at once. Also, this is the other thing that most people, you know, people get it wrong a lot of different ways, but you know this. The fun is not in the destination. If the fun was the destination, you know what I mean? Then like, yeah, the best day of my life would be the day I publish a book and the, you know, I don't know, I've written 12 books. They've, you know, average books takes about 3 to 4 years. So the 3 to 4 years, what, they suck and I get have one good day, right? I mean, that's not how it works. And that's not how it works for anybody. You know what I mean? Right. We love the process is what it's about. It's not the destiny. It's not where you're going to get to. It's in the living. And we all know that.
Okay. So on that note, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about those 4 skills that get it working for us instead of against us. We will be right back with Stephen Kotler. We're all trying our best to manage our daily stress, but the one thing that's worked for so many people is NuCalm. No matter what life throws at you, NuCalm will reduce your stress level. It's the only stress management system of its kind, clinically proven to improve stress, reduce sleep, and boost recovery without drugs and side effects. The NuCalm system consists of a biosignal processing disk and the NuCalm app. It's administered in seconds, takes effect in minutes, and the benefits can last for hours. It's all included in your monthly subscription, which costs less than a daily cup of coffee. Plus, the whole process is easy to use and to work into your daily routine to get better sleep, reduce stress, and boosted recovery.
own the day with Newcomb. We have a special link set up specifically for my listeners. Go to JillianNewcomb.com and get 50% off your 30-day subscription of Newcomb and their money-back guarantee. That's JillianNewcomb.com, JillianNucalm.com. What's the easiest choice you can make? Soup or salad? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From your online start to your first million orders, Shopify's there to help you grow. No matter what your product is, they can help you sell it everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, Shopify can help you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average than other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Jillian, all lowercase. Just go to shopify.com/Jillian now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Jillian. All right, we are back with New York Times best-selling author, award-winning journalist, executive director of the Flow Research Collective, and Pulitzer Prize nominee Stephen Kotler, talking about his book, The Art of the Impossible, A Peak Performance Primer. And Stephen, as discussed before the break, I would like your top line tip, and I really hate when people do this to me, so I apologize. Because again, I understand it took you 3 years to put all this together.
There isn't one thing. But there is a place to start. And because this is where I think it's a good thing for people to start with. It's two, and they're simple, or one simple, because I don't think you, I think both are useful. One, sleep 7-8 hours a night, period. End of discussion. The human body needs 7 to 8 hours of sleep a night. There is no way to achieve the energy levels you need for peak performance if you're sleeping less than 7 to 8 hours a night. You can get away with it every now and again, but it's essentially a non-negotiable for peak performance. And it's never, by the way, this is not what I talk about in the book. It's nowhere, but it's foundational, and people neglect sleep so much, and it's so dumb. And by the way, if you want to prove it to yourself, we all have sleepless nights. There's all kinds of cognitive tests online that tests like cognitive skills while sleep deprived. Just look one up and take one the next time you're tired, and then take the same test the next time you're awake. It is like literally you're moving a level down the evolutionary ladder by trying to perform at lack of sleep. You just are. So that's the second one is this. So I got to talk a little bit about flow for this to make sense. But for those not familiar with the term flow, maybe you've heard the term runner's high or being in the zone, or if you play basketball, being unconscious. The lingo is sort of endless. Flow is technically defined as an optimal state of consciousness where we feel our best and we perform our best. But what we all know is there are those moments where we're doing something that we're into and we get so lost in what we're doing that everything else just disappears, right? Time will pass strangely, like 5 hours will go by in like 5 minutes. And your sense of self-consciousness, it'll get really, really quiet. Maybe bodily awareness will go away, meaning like you'll get so focused on what you're doing, you'll forget that you have to go pee, right? Like that's what I mean. And there's a couple other things that happen, but when we're in this state, everybody performs at their best. All aspects of performance, both mental and physical, as we talked about earlier, sort of go through the roof. Now, in flow science, everybody has what is sort of technically called a primary flow activity. This is that thing you did as a kid, that whenever you did it, you just dropped into flow. It just happened. It was so engrossing. For me, it was skiing, right? That was skiing and writing were my main two flow things, but really skiing. Maybe it was dancing to hip hop. Maybe it was staring at dinosaur bones in the Natural History Museum, or learning to bake with your mother, or walking in nature, or playing with dogs, or riding horses, or whatever the hell it was, right? We all have a primary flow activity. So a couple things that are worth knowing about flow itself. One, when we move into flow, the body flushes all our stress hormones out of our system. It happens automatically, but whatever your stress levels, they go away when we drop into flow. It's because as we move into the state, there's a release of a gaseous signaling molecule, nitric oxide. It's everywhere in the body. It's in every cell in the body, and just gets released, and it pushes all the stress hormones out of your system. Not a bit. I mean, that happens all. It's common. It's whatever. But that's the mechanism. Two, flow is a focusing skill. So it's a kind of like mindfulness is a focusing, a kind of focusing yes. skill. Flow is a focusing skill. It's a different kind of focus. But like any other skill, the more flow you get, the more flow you get. So if flow is optimal performance, if I go skiing on Monday and get into a flow state, Tuesday when I show up at work, I'm going to have a better chance of getting into flow because I've been training the focusing skill the day before. Three, and this is not my work on, so creativity, enormous spike, 400 to 700% when we're in flow. And when I say creativity, this is all aspects of creative problem solving, from idea generation to problem identification, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Everything we mean by creativity soars 400 to 700%. But a really brilliant woman named Teresa Mabla at Harvard figured out that heightened creativity will outlet. Flow states are about, there's no average, but 90 minutes, whatever, give or take. She figured out that heightened creativity will outlast flow by a day or two. So you can reset your nervous system, massively amplify creativity, train up flow, and even better, we know this. The people who have the highest levels of overall life satisfaction, well-being, meaning, and usually happiness are the people with the most flow in your life. It's the recipe. In fact, when psychologists now define happiness and well-being and those things, there's three levels of happiness available to people on the planet. Jesus. Level one is just how do you feel right now? Then there's enjoyment or engagement, and then there's meaning and purpose. Enjoyment and engagement is a high flow lifestyle. Meaning, purpose is a high flow lifestyle attached to something greater than yourself. Meaning, the two highest levels of happiness we can achieve on this planet have flow at their center. So by simply doubling down on your primary flow activity, you get all of this. Now, here's why I mention it. Because you know this from your own life. As we become adults, as we get jobs, as we have children, as we have families, what's the first thing we do? Put down the, what did you say? Oh, that's not responsible. I can't do that thing I love. It's the stupidest thing you could possibly do for yourself. You've literally just stripped yourself of like foundational life gas. It's the dumbest thing we could possibly do, but it's the first thing we do. So the first thing I tell people is just reintroduce that high flow activity a couple hours a week. Start by a half an hour a week, 2 hours a week. You know, I've got people who grew up as dancers, and I've got them dancing 5 minutes between meetings in their office, you know, because they're so freaking busy. They can't, like, they don't have time to go to a dance class or anything like that. But they've got like 3 minutes here and there just to like put on a video and learn how to dance, you know, a hip hop according to some video and blah, blah, blah. Literally rekindle that feeling and start there. It sounds really stupid, but I'm literally telling you.
So you're literally grabbing that
focus. Sleep more and play more. Yeah. Sleep more.
And the focus and the passion and almost like imbuing yourself with that energy and then bringing it to your work.
Because once you start getting a little more flow, a little more juice, and if you've been getting your ass kicked, and who hasn't been getting their ass kicked this past year?
I was going to say, everyone got their ass kicked this past year.
Seriously, what I've been saying about Art of Impossible as a book, and ignore the cheesy tagline, because I really sort of mean this. Like, look, we all got our ass kicked in 2020. I mean, nobody escaped 2020. So Art of Impossible is how we fight back in 2021, right? Like, literally, like, we all lost 2020. We all lost. 2021 is where we come back. And here's something, by the way, that's really important. When the world reboots, when we're all vaccinated, we can go back out, we can resume our lives, everybody wants to get back to work at a really heavy level. But the problem is everything we've been doing during COVID is going to put us, if your anxiety levels are going up, you're not doubling down your primary flow activity. There's a whole bunch of things you're producing the conditions. You're right at the edge of burnout or you're burned out. And you're probably not sleeping enough on top of it. And what's going to happen is life is going to reboot. And you're going to jump back into work at normal levels, and you're going to be on the edge of burnout, and you're going to jump back into the world and not be able to meet the challenge that you're waiting for. So you got to get this stuff done sort of now to get ready for the world that's coming.
We talked about motivation and all the different skills that go under that. We talked about flow state. But creativity, I think, is tough for people because so many don't identify as a creative. And they're like, well, I'm not a creative. I'm not creative. And I know that I would never identify myself as creative. I can't do anything creative. I can't cook. I have no clothing style.
Time out. Back up. You're wearing a Metallica t-shirt and you're pushing the sleeves rolled up, right?
Yes.
You made a choice, right? So people think creativity is some big mystical thing. It's nothing more like a sense of style, for example. Style is simply a choice. I am doing this for a reason, right? People think like I have a number of friends who work for, like my brother works for Microsoft. He chooses to go to work in khakis and a button down. He's a manager. He's purposefully choosing not to have style. His style is not style, but he's doing it for a reason. He's making a choice. I do my job better when I fit in and look like everybody else. I'm making, that's a creative choice, right? People overestimate what creativity is and they underestimate how creative they actually are. And so they don't start training the skill up. You need creativity because you got to steer. It's how you steer through life. Most people think of creativity. And first of all, they think, well, I'm a logical person. I'm not like, you can be logically creative. Of course you can. That's a total misnomer that you can't be logically creative. That's ridiculous. People are logically creative all the time. I mean, maybe you don't want your accountant being logically creative, but actually, but I mean, the truth of the matter, that's what a good accountant is, right? They're like, well, this is the tax law this year, and let's get creative around how we can work with it. That's what an accountant does. The most logical job you can imagine. And a good accountant is they don't break the law, but they work within the law creatively. So everything is creative as far as I can tell. And creativity is literally just it's often about making, you know, small decisions along the way, but it is such a powerful skill for all of us. Because it is how you steer through your life.
You know, what I love so much about who you are and what you do and the book is that you take these concepts that are so seemingly overwhelming and out of reach and grandiose of like creativity. I mean, motivation, that's the number one question I get. How do I get motivated? People don't even know where to begin, let alone going after something that's impossible. And you give people a roadmap to develop all of these skills in a way that's so tangible and simple and accessible. I want to know what is next for Stephen Kotler.
I actually have another book coming out next November. It's a novel. I write novels in between the nonfiction books because it's fun. So that's actually next.
Oh, my God.
Next. I know. You're going to hate me for that
one.
I kind
of want to smack you. I'm a little bit.
I know you do.
You're like, oh,
I'm really freaking happy.
I kind of want to smack you, but that's it's okay.
I'm really happy you can't reach the computer.
No, that's all right. Yeah, but, sorry. Go ahead.
So I guess that's next. But really the next, I've been working all the work in Art Impossible. The next thing is I'm working on intuition, which is insight and intuition to me are like the last uncharted territory of peak performance. They're off of creativity, but they're a little more complicated and they're very relevant in flow. So one of the things that happens in flow is your intuition gets really loud, right? The voice in your head that sort of guides you, it gets turned up. So this is an ongoing question in flow science and has been for a while. And so I'm really interested in that. So that's where I'm personally going next.
There is a little I impossible, right, for each and every one of us. And Stephen's work in this book, The Art of Impossible, shows us that it is within reach for every single one of us. It's just simply about having the information so that the actions you take will yield the powerful, positive results you're after.
Now more than ever, the world needs people to be going big. Like the world needs all of us right now very, very, very much. So, you know, there's a lot more. We're all capable of a lot more than we know. That's the biggest lesson. 30 years studying this stuff is we're all capable of so much more than we know. So, and the world needs us this year.
For more from you, Stephen, can anybody go to, you know, be trained at the...
The Flow Research Collective,
people get more info?
So if you want more info on the book, theartofimpossible.com will get you everything. StephenKotler.com will get you me. FlowResearchCollective.com will get you the Flow Research Collective. But you asked for the one thing, right? I said sleep and then primary flow activity. Let me give you a third thing as a gift to your audience. So there are about six known flow blockers. So if you go to www.flowblocker.com, it's a free diagnostic. We built it for people. It will identify the thing that is standing in your way between you and the most flow. And that if you want to start doing some flow work, flowblocker.com.
Stephen Kotler, The Art of Impossible. Stephen, you're incredible. Thank you so much for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure hanging out with you.